This is A People's Climate, powered by Wild Seeds Fund, from Counterstream Media and The Nation. I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre. I'm so excited to kick off the season with you. Our show is all about people-powered movements, and in today's episode, we're getting into the story of one woman's fight against one of the most powerful chemical companies in the world.
Formosa Plastics is accused of dumping plastic pellets into waterways in Taiwan and in Texas and Louisiana, where it also operates.
Around 30 people stood outside the Formosa plant in Port Comfort this afternoon to initiate a worldwide hunger strike.
The plant has a history of accidents and safety violations. In fact, 14 people were hurt in an explosion back in May. In 2005, an explosion injured more than a dozen workers.
Shut them down! Shut them down!
Ranking members,
this is what it looks like in the marches. This is what it looks like for the people down there. And I think you need to be charged with a crime. You need to go to jail. As a matter of fact, I've got some chains and I'm going to do a self-arrest. You need to be charged with crime.
Formosa Plastics is a $250 billion petrochemical giant. And for decades, they've been polluting the Gulf Coast of Texas with toxic chemicals and billions of tiny plastic pellets. But Diane Wilson, a fourth-generation shrimper and mother of five, didn't let them get away with it. This is a story of shrimp boats, of lawsuits, and the kind of stubbornness that can bend history. Over the last 30 years, Diane has launched successful legislative campaigns, led hunger strikes, and even scaled the White House fence, all in the name of justice. She's been arrested more than 50 times and has never once backed down. Her stubbornness and her belief in the power of ordinary people to create extraordinary change is exactly what we need in this moment. Let's get into it. Welcome to the show, Miss Diane.
Well, thank you very much. I'm real proud to be here.
I kind of want to start with a sense of place, and you're from this little town called Seadrift in Texas.
Seadrift's on the mid-Texas Gulf Coast. It's a very rural county. It's the last authentic fishing village on the Texas Gulf Coast. In the heart and the soul of the entire community was the bay, was the fish house, the boats. And I've been on a boat since I was 8 years old, and I really love it. It's my life, and it's not a job. It's not something I'm doing. It's my identity.
Absolutely. I know that's something that resonated with me when I first met you back in 2018 or 19. And you were talking about how you were a fourth generation shrimp farmer. When I first heard about it, I felt like it was sort of rare for a woman to do in this particular region of the country.
So I've been around it my whole life. I was a boat captain, and that's kind of rare in itself. The other thing that made me really valuable to the fishermen, I'm a pretty dang good net builder. I can build shrimp nets. I can repair them. And that is the main thing. When you are on a shrimp boat, a shrimper especially, is like a good working net will make or break your career.
Who taught you that skill set?
Believe it or not, I kind of taught myself.
That is not surprising. Thanks so much for setting the stage. I want people to understand how special Seadrift is to you. I want to go back to 1989 because this was such a pivotal year for you. There was a shrimper named Bill Bailey who handed you the AP article, and that sort of changes everything for you. I want to know, what did that article say?
Well, it was the first time the toxic relief inventory data that the EPA required, and that it was because after Bhopal, the congressional leaders said, we're not going to have something like this that happens in the United States.
It's the worst industrial disaster in India's history. 30 years ago, on the night of December the 2nd, 1984, plumes of poisonous gas leaked from an American-run chemical pesticides factory in the town of Bhopal in central India.
At one point, an official said one death was being recorded every minute from the poison gas leak in the city of Bhopal.
Toxic gas that escaped from a Union Carbide plant on Monday has killed at least 1,600 people, and they say another 50,000 people may suffer serious after effects such as blindness and sterility.
People are going to know what the industries around them are putting in the sky, putting in the water. We're going to let people know. So 1989 was the first time that TRI data was made public. And it was in the newspaper, and he threw it on the fish house desk where I was working at. And he said, read this. Our county, which is a tiny county at that time, I bet it wasn't no more than 16,000 people. And we were number one in the nation for toxic disposal to the land. We were number three on injection wells. We were number six on emissions. We were like number 20 in the nation on the transfer of hazardous waste. I mean, we were ranking all over the place, and I couldn't believe it because I had never in my entire life seen a single article, TV series or anything ever mentioning anything about the chemical plants.
Well, a lot of people read articles like that, even when it's in their own community, and they feel sad and angry about it, but they kind of move on. That's not the case with you. What happened next?
You know, and a lot of people don't believe this, but I really am a real introvert. I like the solitude of boats. I don't like crowds or anything like that. But that article really upset me. I went down to our little city hall down and I said, I want to have a meeting in that building and I want to talk about this article. The secretary, she just wrote it down. She come down to the fish house and she said, Diane, you cannot have that meeting at the city hall. She just kept saying, it's red flags, you can't do it. The next day, I had the bank president at the Seadrift Bank in a three-piece suit, and here he come out on the dock, and he said, Diane, are you fixing to start a vigilante group roasting industry alive? And I'm like, wow, I haven't even had a meeting. And from there, it escalated. The next day, I got an anonymous letter in the mail, and it just had my name, and it said, Miss Wilson, do you know this? And the writer had clipped out 7 air permits for Formosa Plastics and had no idea who Formosa Plastics was. That was the first time I ever heard of them.
Formosa Plastics.
Formosa Plastics.
Formosa Plastics.
Formosa Plastics.
The Formosa Plastics Corporation is facing over $121,000 in state fines for polluting a tributary of Lavaca Bay.
We are told in each case, tons of plastic pellets, just like the ones you're seeing on your screen, were discharged from the Formosa plant at Point Comfort here in Texas.
A federal judge called Formosa a serial offender.
Formosa Plastic, that's actually based in Taiwan. It is the 6th largest chemical company in the world, actually. Miss Diane here, she sued Formosa in 2017 and she won. She won a historic $50 million settlement. And that's what we're going to get into here. But it was fascinating to hear this actually started in 1989. One of the things that have stood out to me was the evidence. You literally collected millions of plastic pellets. They're also known as nurdles. By hand, it could fill up the back of a pickup truck. In fact, when I first met you in Houston, you had brought those nurdles with you in a mason jar. And this is so indicative of the importance of citizen science and community-led local ecological knowledge. Can you talk to us about this approach and why it made such a difference in this case?
In the beginning, Formosa was making PVC powder, and it was all over the units, all over the road. It was all over the whole community of Point Comfort. It was in their swimming pools, on their cars. It was in their yards.
like tiny flakes of it everywhere?
Yes, the powder, and it was like PVC, and that's polyvinyl chloride.
This is polyvinyl chloride, a synthetic resinous material converted from vinyl chloride gas.
That's often used in building material like vinyl siding, cable coatings, or vinyl tile flooring, and it can be deadly. The World Health Organization, Environmental Protection Agency, and U.S. Department of Health and Human Services have classified vinyl chloride as a known human carcinogen.
I remember at one time I had a meeting with Formosa. I bet there were 20 guys, 20 suits. I said, how many plastic pellets are y'all losing out there? The main guy in this unit, and he like nearly come across the table at me, and he said, we're not losing a single pellet. We sell everyone. And it's like, well, I knew that was a lie right off. And I remember the state environmental executive director said, we don't need to worry about the pellets because it's in the permit. And if Formosa violates it, they'll turn it in. So I went down to the Texas Air Control Board and to the Texas Water Commission, and there wasn't a single violation. The state agency had never penalized them. Formosa had never turned it in, neither the EPA. So that's when we started collecting, January 2016. And we collected for 2.5 years, almost every single day, and had 2,500 samples and about 8,000 photographs and videos.
I did want to ask, because it sounds like you got to talk to a bunch of people on the inside, which is so critical. Why do you think these folks trusted you with this information?
Well, in the beginning, it was people were real intimidated. These are people that are not making a lot of money and they're afraid. For instance, one lady was interested in getting involved, and the bank president and that pulled her into a meeting and said, you're trying to get a loan at the bank and you're not going to get it unless you shut up and sit down. They're totally in tears, scaring them to death. Because it's very hard even now for people to publicly stand with me and stand out. So I was talking to workers who they were either exposed, a worker is exposed or harmed, or if he sees something, if he goes to management, you will be fired. They do not want to hear it. Say you go to the DEA or the sheriff's department and they say, we can't do anything. We're getting a computer system from Formosa. And you find out the mayor is getting contracts with them. Even our senators were getting contracts with them. I even had inspectors at the state agency call me in and give me records and say, do something with them because we can't get it anywhere in Austin. You do something with it.
The historic $50 million settlement in 2019, which was game changing. You didn't take a cent. You could be filthy rich. Where did you take the money?
There was $50 million and we put it into environmental projects in Calhoun County. The most, which was $20 million, we put into creating a sustainable fishery cooperative. The season of shrimping that used to last for months and had like 120 boats. In our community, there were maybe 3 people, and the season was over with in a couple of weeks. It was tragic. The $20 million was to bring it back. We have created one of the co-ops, and it has 240 members, and now they have one of the largest oyster farms in Texas. I think we put $1 million into Nurdle Patrol, which is documenting the plastic that is being found along all of the Gulf Coast. And matter of fact, now it's international.
I'm really hopeful that Seadrift will be looking really different. All of this storytelling right now reminds me of the phrase that you've been coined, which is an unreasonable woman. And I would love to know what that phrase means to you personally.
I know when I started out trying to protect the bays from these chemical plants, you got absolutely nowhere. I mean, it's like the politics was unreal. And so I realized that the only thing I could do was civil disobedience. So I remember the first time someone told me, the campaign is over. I'm at the end of the parade. You did a good job, but it's over. There's nothing you can do. And off the top of my head, I said, I can do a hunger strike. And I remember that guy, he laughed and laughed. He said, people in Texas don't do hunger strikes. He said, maybe California, they don't do them here. And I said, I don't care. I immediately called a reporter and said, I'm doing a hunger strike. And I found out from that one hunger strike that I did with very little media, no support, no budget, no nothing. I got exactly what I wanted in 2 weeks.
Environmentalist Diane Wilson will refrain from eating and strike out in front of the plant until Formosa initiates some sort of response or change.
Diane Wilson was arrested Wednesday for pouring fake oil on herself during a Senate energy hearing.
We are tired of being dumped on in the Gulf. I'm a commercial fisherman from the Gulf of Mexico, and we're tired.
Concern about Diane Wilson, who's in her 57th day of hunger strike. She went over the fence of the White House.
I realized the power of civil disobedience. It's got a soul power. And for me, integrity is the only thing I had. And I believed as a country, we are too well behaved. I used a quote, I misquoted, was it George Bernard Shaw, who said, a reasonable man adapts to the world and an unreasonable man makes the world adapt to him, and all progress is dependent upon unreasonable men. I really believe that. Most of the, you know, I've been doing this almost 40 years now, and I have used civil disobedience, and I still do it.
I want to dig in here a little bit more because your activism doesn't start and stop in Texas. Okay, you're one of the co-founders of Code Pink. It is one of the most vocal and visible anti-war groups in the country that has taken an aggressive stance, a much needed stance against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. What made you want to challenge war and U.S. foreign policy?
I was a medic during the Vietnam War, and I opposed that war because I was there when the war was going on. And when you get young men into, you start on boot camp and you're getting ready to send them to Vietnam, and where they're going to be killing people, is like, how do you get them in that mindset? Well, I was in boot camp with them and I saw how they do it. So you can see where they revved up this kill, kill, kill. And then when they started coming in from their battles and wounded, and they were, to me, they were lost boys because they were so young and they were like lost. And it was tragic. It really was tragic. You know, and in my own hometown, the guys I graduated with who went to Vietnam, three died over there, three committed suicide, and three are 100% PTSD. And it's like, I really have a issue about the war and what we are doing to each other.
Yeah, I mean, you were on the front lines of it. Can I ask you if you see any parallels with Vietnam and Palestine?
Oh, my God. The thought of what is going on in Palestine just kills my soul. And the fact that they are dropping these bombs and the children and the women and the families that are collateral.
There's no words.
Yeah, there's no words that can describe. I cannot believe that we're 2025 and we don't have enough consciousness, our compassion, our empathy to see what we are. I can't believe it. It blows my mind. It totally blows my mind. I was actually on one of the sailboats that were taken to Gaza a number of years ago.
You were on a freedom flotilla?
I was, yeah, because I was a shrimp boat captain. I think it's a terrific idea. And I think they ought to recruit shrimp boat captains.
It's very much an anti-war nonviolence tactic. I do want to talk about the Texas Jail Project because it's another incredible organization you co-founded in 2015. It's now the only advocacy group focused on the state's 254 county jails. And thanks to your work, pregnant women are no longer chained to hospital beds.
That's right. Can you believe?
Right. But why was this particular work so important to you? I can imagine you have seen things inside jails.
After I climbed that chemical tower at Union Carbide, I was arrested and I was fined $2,000 and I got like 3 months in jail. Texas does not have nice jails. People think county jails, oh, you're just in 6 hours and you're out and no problem. There is so many people that are in for long periods of time. They never see a judge and they don't have money to get a bond. When I was in the jail cells, the stories that I learned from the women that were in there were unbelievable. I started compiling a pretty good inventory of some horrific incidents that were happening inside the jail. And we started sending it out. We sent it out to the sheriff. We sent it out to the governors, to every representative we could, because most people, they think if you're in jail, you deserve it. No matter what happens, you deserve it. And I remember how bad that just really makes me when people say that, because I wrote about a woman, a Black woman. There was a warrant for her arrest, but it said, do not pick this woman up. She is pregnant. Do not pick her up. Well, the sheriff was running for office and he wanted to look like he was bringing a lot of people back to the jail. So they went and brought this woman back. They threw her in jail. She started a pre-labor.
Oh, no.
And if you're in the jails, you will find out no matter how bad you feel, if you say you're sick, they think you're lying. She was causing so much trouble by saying she was in labor that they threw her in isolation and she delivered the baby in isolation by herself. And when they realized the baby was dying, then they tried to hurry up and get them to the hospital. So I guess so the baby wouldn't die in the jail and she'd die in the hospital. And so that young woman was not even able to go when her baby was buried.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
or I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Like, 'cause I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
I think it's important to note Formosa is still polluting, and now they just have to pay a fine of $65,000 per violation, which it sounds like a lot until you realize they make over $2 million a day. Can you talk about how our system treats polluters? To me, it almost feels like they get rewarded in a way. You know, they just have to pay a little bit here and there, but they don't have to change their status quo. They keep polluting and producing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The state agency and the feds weren't doing a thing. It's like, I think they want to do something, but the politics is it doesn't happen. And so it ends up with people like us. And sometimes it makes me mad. It's like, what are agencies and our elected officials for? What are they doing? That was an illusion that really burst for me. It's like, I lost all faith in it. I lost hope there from them.
I completely understand it. You know, as someone that has been in the environmental space my whole career, I've never seen a settlement like this for clean water. It's incredible what you've done. However, we're seeing the same playbook again. There's Exxon now planning to build another $8.6 billion plastics facility in Point Comfort. Same promises, same government subsidies, same dumping into the same waterways.
Same waterway.
How are you staying grounded through all of this?
I am a person who is in the moment. I definitely don't look back, and I do what I have to do right then. And I think I've got energy, and I get the energy. I really do. I feel like the things I do feed my soul. I felt better after 30 some odd days of a hunger strike than I did before. And I really feel like there's some sort of electrical exchange, some sort of energy that keeps me going.
Would you say it's spiritual?
Oh, yeah. I'm a bit of a mystic. I'm actually a bit of a mystic, yeah.
One final question for you. You have paid a personal price for your work and for your advocacy. Are you comfortable speaking about what has actually transpired in your day-to-day life?
I have talked with some women activists before. It's a common thread because eventually I lost my husband. I lost my marriage, the house that I lived in. I lost that. The fish house I was working at, I got fired from because he was afraid it was going to get burned down. I lost my boat. But the thing I always say is I never liked myself so well that you truly can lose it all and gain your soul. I have a great deal of peace with myself, a great deal.
I'm not alone in how amazing and incredible I think you are. You may call yourself unreasonable, but in a world poisoned by corporate greed, cowardly politicians, demanding clean water, clean air might be the most reasonable thing anyone could do.
It was beautiful.
We are so grateful to be in community with you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for allowing me a voice. Thank you for that.
Diane's story is living proof that taking on polluters and broken systems is possible. She went up against a multi-billion-dollar corporation and won. It's a reminder that lasting change takes persistence and sometimes a little stubbornness. And that's it for our very first episode of the season. We're just getting started, and we've got so many more powerful conversations coming your way. If you liked what you heard, hit follow, share this episode with a friend, and tune in next week. And if you want to get in touch with us, drop us a line at hello@apeoplesclimate.org. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you to Wild Seeds Fund for making this podcast possible. This episode of A People's Climate is executive produced by Mindy Raymaker, with engineering and sound design by Francisco Nunez Capriles. Theme music is by Coffrey J. Additional research and support by Marianella Nunez and Sarah Morgan. Recorded at Studio 132 in Oakland. From Counterstream Media and The Nation, I'm your host, Shilpi Chotre. Until next time.